My peoples, welcome to Rants and Randomness. I am Lovey Ajayi, your side-eye sorceress and wacky wordsmith. And this is my podcast where I'm talking about the things I'm loving, things I'm side-eyeing, and having great conversations with amazing people. I'm here at the Chicago Recording Company bringing you the radio voice, you know what I mean, as always. And on this episode, my feel-good is about how I'm doing a massive purge of my life, ranting about why people need to respect Serena Williams, and spotlighting Black Girls Rock. My guest is the incredible host, author, just dope person, Darnell L. Moore. And yeah, so let's jump into it. This week, I'm feeling good about purging my closet, my office, my house. Because what happened is I end up looking at my office, just looking around everywhere. There's junk everywhere. There's clutter everywhere. Now, here's the thing. Because I'm an influencer, and because I'm a writer, all that stuff, I get a lot of free things sent to me, which I love. I love free stuff. Love it. But what happens is it all piles up because I'm not using all of it. And I look up months later and realize there's entire rooms in my house that is full of junk and stuff. Useful stuff, mind you. But I can't use it because I'm only one person. So this Sunday, I decided to just spend the entire day, I'm talking 12 hours, creating piles of what I'm donating, what is no longer good that I need to throw out, what I need to give away to friends and family, what I need to post on eBay or whatever. So I literally dedicated the entire day to this pursuit. At the end of the day, I'm pretty sure I ended up giving away or like getting rid of probably 100 pounds worth of stuff. I'm talking 2 lamps, blenders, shoes, makeup, all types of stuff. It was very productive. And I was Insta-storing it. If y'all aren't following me on Instagram, you should. I'm at Lovey. Because I wanted to see if anybody else was purging. And it seemed that that day was a purging day for us. Like, t-shirts. I have probably 50 graphic t-shirts. I gave away, no, probably more than that. I gave away about 20 so far. And then there's a nonprofit in Chicago that I'm going to donate a lot of my clothes to called Project Style. And they use fashion to empower young girls to basically live their best lives. So my whole thing is it is always good to purge because it creates space. The things that you don't need that aren't serving you, let them go and give it to somebody else who can. So I even found old phones, and I found out that I can donate those to domestic shelters because they'll give them to women who are trying to escape abusive situations. For everything, there's somebody else who can use it when it's just collecting dust. So that purge felt good. I called it phase one because I still have things I can let go of. So I'm going to keep doing that. But so far, the fact that I got rid of so much stuff and I have more space makes me feel amazing. I encourage you to purge. My rant this week is about the continued disrespect of Serena Williams. Serena Williams is one of the greatest athletes of all time. She's also one of the most disrespected athletes of all time. She's been playing tennis for over 20 years, well, as a professional. And she's proven herself over and over and over again about why she deserves to be called one of the greatest athletes of all time. Nike now has a building for like, named after her because they understand she actually is the greatest of all time. Now, what comes with this, because Serena is a Black woman, is that people do not want to give her the credit that she deserves. And people will constantly try to act like she did not earn her way to where she is. Like, it's the intersection of racism and sexism, what she's enduring in tennis and just in general, how she's talked about in media, how they try to, how Tennis Association deals with her. One of those things is the fact that Serena is actually one of the most drug-tested athletes. According to Deadspin, she's been tested for performance-enhancing drugs more than twice as often as other top American women players. As in, they can show up at her house on any given day to be like, hey, we're going to test you in case you're taking all these drugs that will enhance your performance. Now, in her 23-year career, like professional career, she's never tested positive for drug, like for performance-enhancing drugs. But she's also the most tested because I feel like they don't really believe that she can be that good without the help of chemical substances. It's like they're like, we're gonna catch you one of these days. Y'all still ain't caught her, okay, because she's not drugging, because this is just pure hard work. This is athleticism. This is work ethic. Y'all gonna give Serena some time. And then this, what happened was the U.S. Open. Who knew the U.S. Open could be controversial? Okay, I'm just thinking tennis. Okay, two athletes. Serena Williams playing against Naomi Osaka, who's a 20-year-old who was half Haitian, half Japanese. And she basically ended up being disrespected because the umpire penalizes her with a game point. And because Serena was basically standing up for herself. The whole event makes me upset because it is the perfect capture of, one, what it's like to be a black woman who's amazing at the work that you do. Because people are going to constantly try to discredit you. People are going to constantly get mad because you advocate for yourself. Because they will call you angry and aggressive. They will say that you are not being a team player. And when she said to the umpire, "You owe me an apology," it was like she was saying it for every black woman who's been in that position, who anytime she wants to just speak up for herself, she's told to sit down. A cartoon came out in the Herald Sun, the Australian Herald Sun, from a cartoonist called Mark Knight that showed Serena. He drew Serena basically as a brute who's throwing a tantrum, breaking her racket, with a pacifier next to her, and drew Naomi Osaka as a blonde girl to further other Serena, because they're like, you know what, we want to point out the fact that this really black girl is throwing a tantrum on the field. Here's the thing, in tennis and sports in general, men throw tantrums all the time. Have you ever seen John McEnroe footage? The dude will almost tackle the umpire. So for Serena to be the one that's singled out, like, they fined her $17,000 for this. It's maddening. And to get this type of disrespect constantly, for me, it's just like, it's just racist, it's despicable, I'm appalled by it. And she always deals with it with so much grace. After being constantly tested for drugs, after having your opponents write chapters and memoirs blaming you for their losses, after the media wants to call you all the names but a child of God, I would want to just dropkick everybody in the face. But Serena's always like, you know, I'm just going to keep playing my sport. She doesn't deserve any of the disrespect that she gets. She has worked so hard, and I mean, I don't know what else people want from this woman. She's proven time and time again that she's earned every single win that she's gotten on that field. That even when they're trying to tell her, you know, you can't wear that outfit because they think it's disrespectful to other people, which, how is me wearing a black cat suit disrespectful to the sport? Okay, no matter what they throw at her, Serena always comes up on top. And I find it important that we continue to speak up for her, because how much fighting can she do for herself in these places? So we have to constantly affirm her. We need to publicly support her. Billie Jean King, who's her idol, said on Twitter, "When a woman is emotional, she's hysterical and she's penalized for it. When a man does the same, he's outspoken and there are no repercussions. Thank you, Serena Williams, for calling out this double standard. More voices are needed to do the same." So even Andrew Roddick, who retired from tennis, said on Twitter, "I've regrettably said worse and I've never gotten a game penalty." So Serena, I just, you know, you probably don't listen to Rant and Randoms, but in case you do, you know, I just want to let you know that they come at you because they see your power, but they cannot stop it. And we see you, we stand with you, and things get rough, but you've already clinched your spot as a GOAT, greatest of all time. So even if Serena never plays another tennis game, which of course she will, because that's what she does and the game needs her, even if she never plays it, she's already a Hall of Famer in tennis. Like, she never has to do, like, the racket never has to be picked up again. But I'm just heartened and inspired by how much she handles this, how well she handles this, the grace under constant fire, how people try to come for her body and her skills and her human, her character, and she always stands up tall. And now she has a daughter, so she's like, "Look, I'm definitely unbothered about y'all because I have a whole human to raise," and she's married and she seems happy. But on this court, she still deserves way better treatment. And I'm hoping that one day we get to the point where black women do not constantly have to not just be good at our jobs, but then we also have to babysit people's egos because they feel bad when they lose to us. Serena is going to always win, even when she doesn't win on the court. My spotlight this week is Black Girls Rock. So Black Girls Rock was created by Beverly Bond in 2006 to celebrate Black women who are trailblazers, changemakers, or dynamos in their respective fields. It really shows the importance of creating spaces to celebrate Black women because there are so many spaces that won't and don't, and so many spaces that tell us that we don't deserve to be celebrated, which is why Black Girls Rock is really important. The mission of the actual organization is to change the world by empowering Black girls to lead, innovate, and serve. And Black Girls Rock, Inc. is a 501c3 nonprofit that has been committed to enriching girls through leadership, education, positive identity development. I've actually spoken at the Black Girls Lead Conference, which Beverly throws every year in summer, where she brings about 70 young girls for 3 days to talk to boss women, women who are doing amazing things. And it's such a good space for these girls to see what's possible, because a lot of us don't understand what's possible unless there's an example of it in front of us. Black Girls Rock is also a multifaceted movement dedicated to shifting the cultural paradigms of media and music that often negatively impact women and girls. So the awards show happens once a year where Black Girls Rock honors Black women who are just doing dope stuff. And it just happened. Black Girls Rock 2018 just aired. Naomi Campbell won the Black Girl Magic Award. Janet Jackson won the Rockstar Award. Judith Jameson won the Living Legend Award. Lena Waithe was a Shot Caller of the Year. Mary J. Blige was a Star Power Awardee. And my girl Tarana Burke was a Community Change Agent. It's 2 hours of us celebrating those of us who are breaking through and able to live the lives we want to live and do amazing work. If you haven't watched the show, BET has been re-airing it, so catch one of those. I'm especially proud of Tarana Burke, who is the woman behind the Me Too movement. I've known Tarana for probably 6 years and seen her on that stage dressed in all gold, looking like a trophy herself. I was like, you better come on. Black Girls Rock is important. It's not just an affirmation, even though that affirmation, we need to say it over and over again, Black Girls Rock, because in a world that doesn't let us, that doesn't want to affirm our value, that can't be taken for granted. But just having that hour or 2 hours, which, by the way, was hosted by Queen Latifah this year, to pause, to really applaud and give people their roses while they're here, you cannot underestimate it. And it's just good work being done. Beverly actually just came out with a book this year that I contributed to, called Black Girls Rock, that has chapters written by different women. I'm talking like Ava DuVernay wrote a chapter. There's Jessica O. Matthews, who runs Uncharted Play, wrote a chapter. And it's this gorgeous coffee table book that allows you to see what people who are visible and doing this great work are up to and their views on life. Lupita Nyong'o wrote a chapter. It's dope. Y'all pick it up. That's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere where books are being sold. But basically, it's a movement. It's the continued love and celebration and affirmation of Black womanhood, Black girlhood in this time where it's so necessary. So showing love to Black Girls Rock, all the things, you know, the show, the nonprofit, the conference, the book, y'all do that too. Follow them on social media, Black Girls Rock, I think on all social platforms. And let's keep supporting each other and let's keep being loudly vocal about how dope we are. And one day all of us will start really believing that we do rock. So, Rants and Randomness fan, I am so excited to welcome author, activist, and just dope person, my friend Darnell Moore, to the show. Darnell, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Let me give people your bio so they understand that is on your that's on this side. So, Darnell L. Moore is head of strategy and programs for U.S. for Breakthrough TV. He is former editor-at-large at Cassius, Urban One, a columnist at LogoTV.com, NewNext.com, and a contributor to Mike, where he hosted their widely viewed digital series, The Movement, which is so good, y'all. Y'all should check it out. he writes regularly for Ebony, Advocate, Vice, Guardian. He was one of the original Black Lives Matter organizers organizing bus trips from New York to Ferguson after the murder of Michael Brown. Moore is a writer in residence at the Center of African American Religion, Sexual Politics, and Social Justice at Columbia University. He's taught at NYU, Rutgers, Fordham, Lord, Darnell, Jesus. And he was trained at Princeton Theological Seminary. His first book, No Ashes in the Fire, came out in May 2018. Y'all, welcome, Darnell, okay?
Hey, hey, y'all. That bio is... I can't stand bios.
You know what? I hate whenever people read my bio, too, because I'm always like, this is the longest thing ever.
It's hard, but I mean, I feel so... I don't know. Bios are so... I don't know.
But it's because, like, you've done so much, so sometimes seeing it reflected back to you kind of makes you blush a little bit.
Blush, and then, you know how it is. What I've done now, like, rather than people say, like, what do you do? I now say, do you want me to tell you what I love? And that really shapes a different type of conversation.
I like that. So when people ask you, what do you love? What do you say?
I say I love using whatever skills, talents, access points I have to spark transformation within our communities and to do stuff for the love of Black people in whatever ways I can. That's typically how I respond. So whether that's writing, whether that's teaching, whether that's organizing, with communities, whether it's me using media to do my work, all of it is grounded in the same goal, and that's to make sure that our folk are good and that they're represented and that we can transform our world.
I love that, because that does change the conversation.
You see how it changes?
It does.
You know, when people typically, what they do when they ask you, like, what do? They want to know how you make money.
Yes, yes.
Like, what's your job? Like, what you doing that pay you bills? And I'm like, well, that's not the important part. What's important is what I do is work that feeds my spirit and my stomach. And that's the gift.
Come on. Listen. And you know, like the whole what do you do thing, it's interesting because many of us do so many things, so it becomes hard. Mm-hmm. The what do you love kind of shows your spirit and shows your heart and why you do what you actually do.
Exactly.
Ooh, I love it. So I usually start by asking, when you were little Darnell, what did you want to be when you were growing up, do when you were growing up?
Oh, my gosh. So let me just paint a picture for y'all. Like, little Darnell was dressed up, I call it church clothes. If anybody, I was a little thin, scrawny little boy, big glasses, dress pants that were like floods with little white socks on and church shoes and trench coats. The funniest thing, I used to wear suits and vests. I wanted to be a preacher.
Really?
And a doctor. Those are the two things I wanted to do. I loved church. I used to like seeing the Black folk in that Holiness Pentecostal church I went to, flipping out and shouting and catching the Holy Ghost in their pews. And I used to play, so I did that. I used to play church with my sisters and my cousin, like I was a pastor. And I used to play school where I would be the teacher. That's what I wanted. And a doctor, like, it's funny, like, all of those things, at the core of it is all about, like, helping professors.
Yeah.
And in so many ways, I've sort of done that. You know, I graduated from seminary, so I've done the preacherly thing, and I got a degree in clinical counseling, so I've done the sort of helping therapist thing. And I see resonances of all those things in my work now. I get to preach, but it's just a different message in a different pulpit.
And you do be preaching. Like, Darnell's writing, he be over here dropping sermons. And in his book, preaching, okay? So when you wanted to be a preacher growing up, how does that work for somebody who's like 8 or 10 or 12, the ages where children are really kind of like carefree? Wanting to be a preacher so young, that means you were very focused on this idea that your purpose was to help people.
You know what's funny? Like, I was a young boy. Like, I really was in the... Like, this sounds so corny and a little weird, but, like, I used to take the Bible with me. I used to sneak the Bible into my bathroom and read the Bible. Like, reading the books, too, that really... Like, Numbers and Ecclesiastes, that don't really got a lot to say. And I was reading those scriptures very young, and I would talk to God just like I'm talking to you. And this is before I was, like, formally introduced to the church. So I've always had this this affinity for spirit. an affinity for connection. I think a part of it had to do with so much hell was kind of going on in my home at the time, a lot of intimate partner violence. And I think what happens when, like, shit is happening in your life, you know what I'm saying, particularly as kids, when hell is breaking loose, you really don't have a lot of people to call on for help. You sort of, it's when spirit is more pronounced, or at least you feel like you have this access to something bigger than your present circumstances that can help you, that can help us. So I would pray, like, for A's, all A's on my report card, and I also pray for God to take my dad out of my house because he was harming my mother. And those, I swear to you, I would say it just like that. God, can you please help me to get all A's on my report card when I'm in Mrs. Troop's class? And can you get my dad out of my house? And surprisingly enough, I got all A's on my report card. And I was like, God is real. And, you know, my dad, eventually the abuse would stop because at some point he was incarcerated, actually. And then eventually moved out. But for young people, I think it's important to remember that, you know, young people have spiritual lives, that young people have curiosities, that we dream, that young kids are actually, like, thinking deeply about the world and their circumstances. And sometimes, you know, and I was still playing on my big wheel. I was still doing other things that kids do. But I saw the world. I saw what was going on. And I think sometimes we forget that kids can see or perceive what's happening in the world, even if we don't think they can.
And kids have this ability to be able to kind of shield themselves from what's happening in the world. So
yeah,
as you tell these stories, all of this is actually in No Ashes in the Fire, your book that just came out in May. And I told you that I read that book in like a week. Your book was so vulnerable. It was so open. It was introspective. It was just, you could see your heart in the words. One of the things about your book that stood out is when you were talking about growing up in your household and your father being abusive. I want you to kind of talk about how you were able to write that. How were you able to take that and put it on paper?
Wow. It was hard work. I rented a place in Atlanta for about 3 months, and I went down there to write at least the first part of the book by myself. So I was in this house by myself, and I looked a mess, Lil. Like, oh my gosh. Like, I remember calling some friends on FaceTime, and I was like, why you look like that? And I was like, because I'm sitting here by myself, like, revisiting these memories, and you're not just writing, putting memories on a page. Like, you're actually traveling back to the feelings, to the emotions, right? You're welcoming those things back. So to think about moments, a scene, for example, where I'm recalling, like, a moment of either intimacy. You know, I talk about moments of beauty and intimacy with my father, and I feel the sort of fuzziness that comes in my belly from that. And I also talk about moments where I see him acting wilding out. And to think about those scenes always brings back recurrent feelings. And it was really hard, right? And I laugh now. I was telling my publisher, I say this all the time when I'm on book talks, like, publishers for Black writers who are particularly interested in telling stories that are complex, meaning they may have hope, they may be hopeful, they may make you laugh, sometimes they may make you cry, but for the most part, when you Black, writing words within an anti-Black world, within a world, if you're queer, that's anti-queer and trans, like, sometimes you're going to be writing about trauma, traumatic shit, and I'm like, publishers need to be in our contracts saying, like, yo, and I'm going to make sure, you don't just get this advance, but we're going to make sure you got a therapist, too.
Yes.
We're going to pay for it.
Yes.
I think that's, like, necessary. I, like, all Black writers, they need to get a therapist. Like, what's up?
Yes. Yes. I fully agree, because in reading your book, and one of the gifts that you have with words is it transforms you in, like, it takes you into the moment that you're describing. So as you're describing the moments of beauty, like, I can almost feel you smiling through these words. And then when you're describing the moments of trauma, I literally sometimes have to put the book down to be like, whew, okay, let me keep on going. Like, as a writer, how do you capture that? And that's really hard. That's really, 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 really hard, because you're putting your heart on paper.
And that's really what it was. Like, I kept thinking, like, if I'm going to write this book, you know, Coates did say, there's one point he's interviewed, I can't remember what publication, and they said, like, what advice would you give to somebody writing a memoir? And he said, to not fucking lie.
Ooh, that's it.
And I was like, damn. So I can't, if I'm gonna write this, I gotta tell the truth, yeah? And the truth means, like, it means bearing one's heart on a page. And I wanted people to really get a sense of what it feels like within the life world of, like, not only my life, but, you know, I wrote about, my parents were young when I was born, you know, 15 and 16, and I wanted to readers to get a sense of what it might feel like to be a young parent. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Like, I'm like, I can barely take care of myself now. I'm old. I got gray in my beard. I make relatively good money. You know what I'm saying? I got resources and access to people. If I need help, you know, if some cop do some dumb shit to me, like, I can call somebody up, you know right. what I'm saying, and get, like, legal representation. But my parents were 15 and 16. Mm. You know what I mean? And, like, I barely be cooking good dinners for myself now. I don't right. even know where my food will come from. And I'm like, how do they do that every day?
Yep.
How do they feed me? Like, how do they make provision? And I wanted, like, to really bring to the fore, like, the life of Black people who grew up in spaces like I did, like Camden, New Jersey. Let me holler and represent Camden, New Jersey real quick.
Hey, now.
That's home. And I'm like, this is a story about us. This is a story about my city, my family. Young people who may or may not have endured and strived and thrived through some things like I did. It's a story about survival. It's a story about love and hope. And that took a lot out of me. I will say, on this side of the, like, the book is done, I'm a different person because of it. Like, I feel so much more whole. Like, literally, my father passed while I was writing a book. The writing of the book became, like, cathartic. It was healing for me. And I actually feel so much closer to him on even as he transcended into the spirit than I did before I wrote the book. So it helped.
Yeah, this book, I feel like this book is a love letter to your life thus far. Mm. Like,
y'all, Lovey said it's a love letter to my life. I'm going to make sure that's on the paperback.
Yes.
That quote will be on the paperback. Yeah.
This book is a love letter. Like, it's like, you can see you forgiving yourself for your past mistakes and forgiving your parents and just becoming the person that you are now. Why was now the time to write it? Because I'm sure you've thought about doing it before. Why were you finally ready?
I don't know if we ever are really ready. You know what I'm saying? Like, the book that is here is not the book I wanted to write. I didn't really want to write a memoir because I was like, that felt grand. It felt narcissistic and grandiose. Like, I ain't do shit. Like, what am I going to write about? You know, because we have this idea that memoirs are supposed to be these grand gestures of success, or like one about overcomers who can talk about, you know, like, a certain type of person is supposed to write a memoir. You're supposed to be older. You're supposed to have done some shit. Like, this is what I thought. But that's a misreading of the genre. Memoir is not autobiography. It's not like, you know, I'm telling a sort of chronological story from my birth until now. Memoir is a form, it's personal writing. It's life writing. That if you can do it well, should somehow draw out themes that can connect to larger worlds and communities. And I wrote it now because, you know, I was working on a book that was more cultural criticism. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was more head and less heart. And as people would read the drafts, they were like, you know what's sticking out to us? Your stories. And we would love to hear more of your stories. And what it made me think about, which is why I, like, applaud you for your work, so much of what theory attempts to do is sort of blocked because of language.
Mm-hmm.
Who gets to have access to what language? We talk to the choir, yeah? Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do was to use stories without ever having to use words like intersectionality.
Mm-hmm.
Without ever having using words. I didn't have to say, like, Black feminism or words that we know. We get it, right?
Right.
I could just use stories. I could talk about my mom. All I have to know is my mom had me at 16. She had to drop out. She was forced to drop out of school. She was forced in so many ways, right, to get government assistance. She had to raise four kids, making a minimum wage that was something like $3.75 an hour,
wow.
Picking boxes off the back of, like, that, without me ever saying intersectionality. By the time you read her story, you'll get it.
Yep.
That's what intersectionality is about. Yep. It was specifically written with her in mind, right? So that's why I wrote the book now. And secondly, that last thing I say is, like, I really am, with as much as we have, like, representation, I'm not... we say we need more representation of Black, queer, and trans and gender nonconforming voices. Yeah, we get bits of it here and there. We have Moonlight, we have Pose FX, which I love them both, right?
Yeah.
We have the work of playwrights like Danje R. Love. We have a bunch of writers who are writing. Charlene Carruthers, shout out Charlene.
Love me some Charlene.
Just came out with Unapologetic,
yeah.
A Black Feminist Queer Mandate for Radical Movement. So these books, we have Patrice Cullors' books, we have a lot of stuff. But it's still not enough. Those, like, on a grand scale, within an industry that is largely, a publishing industry that's largely white,
yep.
that is largely organized around the needs of Black, white male writers, which means that if you're Black, one, if you're a Black woman, two, if you're, like, Black, queer, and trans, and woman, three, and still not writing, like, within sort of these range of respectability, like, with using language you're trying to write for your people, it's even harder. It's less. We know it because this is our tribe.
Right.
We know these names, but in the large scale, we still need more. So I was writing against that. I was writing to say that Black, the narratives of Black, queer, trans, gender nonconforming people too, especially those who are economically disenfranchised, especially those who are not always imagined as alive and respected in our freedom dreams, our stories deserve to be told too.
Absolutely. And that one thing I was saying when I actually, so I hosted Darnell's book talk in Chicago. I think your book is going to give a young queer Black boy the language to speak about who he is. Mm. And that is what we're talking about when we're talking about not preaching to the choir, because we can talk to each other, those of us who have platforms and voices every day, but it's how do the people who don't have this get to speak? And
exactly.
Part of what you did in this book is to give that language. And there's one of my favorite parts of this is when you told your mom that you were gay.
Mm.
And you said she gave you the freedom.
Yeah.
I want you to talk about that.
She gave me the freedom. It's so funny. I did an event yesterday with Charlene Carruthers at the Schomburg,
yes!
And I read from, and we talked about you. We lifted your name, and I read that part of the book because, you know, like I lived 28 years walking with fear. That my family, who I knew, who never demonstrated anything but love for me, would somehow reject me if I were to. And I don't now say coming out; I say inviting in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I ain't gotta come out of shit. I ain't in. You know, straight people don't gotta come out. Y'all come out of shit. Like, what? Like, I invite you in. It's an
yes.
act of hospitality, an act of grace,
yes.
to be invited into these to the deepest parts of my life. So. When I went to her, I was at work. I called her to my job. I sent her a text message, actually. And, you know, it was some old school phones, like the flip phones. And I was like, damn, as I was watching The Lion Go, I was like, I hope it don't go through. And it did. And she got it. And she responded right away. And I think she was waiting. She had been waiting for me to talk to her. And she came to my office. She's like, what's wrong? And I was like, she's like, what's wrong? And I was like, you know. She asked me if I was sick. She asked me if I had cancer, if I had AIDS. And I said no. And I just said, I have a boyfriend. And she's like, I knew that already. Like,
yeah, because mamas be knowing.
What? She's like, I was just waiting for you to say something. and she's like, and your sisters know too, by the way. We've been talking about this for years.
You the only one who ain't know they do.
You the only one. You ain't the only one that ain't know. But she said, you know, but you're my son. And I love you. And she also said, I want you to know that anyone that cannot love you don't deserve to be in your life. And she
yes.
said, you know, that means people, your friends, and the church. And I swear to you, like, that moment was pivotal for me. It won. Yeah, I was like, I literally had this thought, like, I'm about to go get a shirt that be like, I'm gay as hell. And my mama loves me, so I don't give a fuck what you think. Like, I was going to get a shirt. but then I was like, damn, like something, what it demonstrated was the power of affirmation
mm-hmm.
and acceptance. And I cannot say this enough, especially to parents. That moment when mama or dad or sister or brother or whoever, family that you created, look you in the face and said, I see you and I love you, can mean a difference between someone living or not. Because that was a moment in my life when I was really, 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 really trying to take myself out of here.
Wow.
Her saying that to me gave me the additional push that I needed to literally live.
Wow.
And I'm just so grateful for her. Like, she, the next day, My mom still to this day does not drive because she old, you know, she old school from the city. she make everybody else drive her ass around though. But
she got
on a train, as she should, she deserves it, traveled 2 hours away by public transportation to come hear me give a keynote in Newark and to meet my partner, who, when she met him, she didn't speak for like the first day. She was like, you know, hey.
Because you know they got to be funny acting at first for everybody.
Exactly.
That's like, her baby.
She gave very much the side eye. Like, her side eye game was strong boots. Like, she was like, not flinchy. but it was an act of love. Like, and she helped me to live, and I say that everywhere I go.
Listen, that... Oh, my goodness. We just do not understand the power of our words to other people in the moments that they might need it the most, and they don't even realize it.
And, like, the power of our silences, too. Because I told her, you know, the reason why I say inviting in, because it takes the onus off of the one person who is expected to name oneself or disclose oneself. And invitation, that invitation is for all of us. Because as a parent, I told her, you know, you could have always said something to me. It's like, you know, I didn't know how you respond, but I'm like, imagine if you would have said this to me six years ago, 12 years ago, you know, after them boys tried to, you know, jump me and tried to light me on fire. Like, imagine if you would have said, like, dude, like, you are my son. I know these kids out here picking on you because of what they think, but I want you to look in the mirror and love yourself.
And
love every part of yourself, right? Like, do you know how that could have shifted the landscape of my life? And this is why I'm like with young people.
Yeah.
This is why I really do my work for them, you know, because I'm like, I want them, like you said, I want some young person to read that book or to hear. So I don't care. It's somebody's work to watch something, to get access to something so they can see themselves and know that they're worthy of love and life.
Yeah. Yeah. That is so real. Wow. Imagine if she had said that 6 years ago. Yeah. We always think we have more time.
Yeah.
We always think we have more time.
a young kid, and I'm just damn it, I'm hating myself for not being able to remember his name. But a young boy over the last 2 weeks, I think 9 years old, have been being picked on in school and committed suicide.
Yes. I heard about that. Let me see.
You know what I mean? Like nine.
Honestly, we think we're further along than we really are. Like, we assume, because we might have queer friends, openly gay friends, trans friends. We're like, oh, the world is accepting. No, the world is still full of trash people who will, other people for not living the lives they live. So it's always a moment of shock for me to hear stories about the little boy who killed himself because he was being bullied for being gay. His name, I just pulled up his name, Jamel Miles.
Yes. Yeah. You should say his name. That's right.
Like, nobody deserves
that. That haunts me, you know, and I'm, from what I can tell, like, his parents loved him, you know, but I was telling people, I don't care, you know, we say, like, black girls rock, and black girls are magic, or black boy magic, or black people are magic. And I'm like, I don't care how magical we are. I don't care how strong we are. Sometimes you don't have enough magic within oneself and your possession or enough strength to move against constant streams of hatred.
Yep.
You understand what I'm saying? Like, yeah, black trans women are like goddesses. It's just what we say. They're also being killed at unprecedented numbers. Like, I think I lost count, but it was like 19, like, just this year, like, three folk just last week in the same city, three trans women. So, like, it is this idea, you know, that black people have to always be so strong and that, you know, black girls always have to be so magic. Ain't that much magic in the world.
Ain't that
many wands in the world you can whip out when you're under constant attack, you know?
Yep. Like, Serena, like, which is why we have to constantly be like, look, like, we are here for you as they try to tear you down. I think it's a constant work to make sure that we are doing the community work to lift each other up. Because when the rest of the world is pointing arrows at us, we got to be the soft place that we land on. So
I'm like, y'all really going to find Serena 17th? Like, really?
Yes.
I wanted to start, like, a GoFundMe. Like, let's pay that shit.
Like, look, Serena gonna pay it off like a bucket. But imagine, exactly. Like, the fact that she shouldn't even have to. It's maddening. It's actually maddening, which is why we have to be super, super, super committed to being ultra pro-black. I'm talking, we got to do something to nullify the rest of the world's foolishness.
Exactly. Let me tell you, like, my mantra is this. We cannot do to each other what the system does to us. And I always say, you know, if we are black and we're in a world that is always at the ready to dispose of us, we can't turn around and dispose of one another. And that means, and particularly in a moment like this, where things like call out culture, where things like sort of retribution and punishment, which are consequences of us being socialized. I'm using these fancy words. Like, we've been taught to believe that the only way that we can manage people is to lock them up, discard of them. Literally, like, you know, we have prisons and jails. We know that mostly black people are in them. So that when we're in community, that's the way we respond to one another. But we can't do that. Like, radical black love is about, you know, so we hear people talking about abolishing prisons because we understand that they are not routes to freedom. But I mean on a micro level. I'm talking about on a level of relationships. Like, if we dispose of one another, we only aid white supremacy. So I've been on this kick where I'm really thinking hard about what it means. So the danger in talking about not disposing of people is, like, we don't have the language or the imagination, or some of us, right? We don't have the reality of what it means to deal with people beyond punishment. And the way I explain this is, like, I come from a family, a black ass family from Camden, a large family that my grandparents' home was always full. Like, you know, my mom and I, my sisters and I lost our home. It was destroyed. They took us in, right? So I was on one couch. My mom was on the couch. My sisters was upstairs. My aunt and her kids were there. Like, we filled that house up. Like, it was like we was all up in there on quilts laying all over the place. But this is important because what it means is that I don't care what you did. You might have, like, did some horrible shit the week before, cussed out a cousin, stole something from the house. You might be out there going through some substance abuse issues or just getting out of jail. If you knocked on that door, they will never let you go without eating or put you on the street. You will never go houseless. That's the type of family I had. And to me, that is a sort of representation of, like, radical black love. It means thinking about what systems need to be put in place so that all can be welcome, even the people that do wrong. Not that we do wrong and not hold them account.
Right.
Nah, we hold people accountable. We create the conditions for folk to name their wrongs and to get better. But, like, in times like these, to your point, it's about, like, loving each other enough to say, like, look, we're going to figure out how we're going to all get right. But because we know that there's a world that's ready to tear you up, we're going to bring you back in. And that shit's real. That's just real. That's why I look at people, like, I admire, like, it takes a lot of bravery to be out here and be on, like, the social media world and in the world being a media maker.
Yeah.
I've gotten quiet over the last 2 years. I remember Nicki Minaj fans tore me to threads one time. And I was like, I ain't going back on the Twitters no more.
It's rough.
And all I said was, I laughed when I was on a date and somebody said that Nicki Minaj was the greatest female rapper. And I said, ha, ha, ha. Baby, them things came at me
so hard. They came at you. I mean, I know I've experienced it. It's tough, especially when your peoples are the one, like, you know, coming for your neck. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's one of those moments where it's like, did we forget grace? I also feel like when you brought up therapy earlier, I was thinking, like, honestly, I feel like we now wear our pains as badges of honor, and then we dispose of it on social, as opposed to dealing with it in a space like therapy. And I really hope more of us seek it out because it's really helpful.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's easy. I always say, like, social media, what it does, it really does allow us to operate as avatars. And avatars as opposed to, like, complex human beings, right, with feelings, who can be seen as having feelings. who can be seen as having hurts and joys and pain. So what you do is you can attack a thing that you only feel is like inanimate.
Hmm.
You know, you're a representational self, like not a real human being, right? And we deal with each other in that way, which is why like I have to navigate very cavalierly because I want to remember like, okay, on the other end of this, like I know that folk only sometimes find community within virtual space and I respect that.
Yeah.
But I'm also like, you know, sometimes we gotta, like, I want all of us to be surrounded by the type of support and the type of care in the real world, too. And virtual reality is real. Social media is real community and real space. But like you said, I think so many times we act out or like, yes, we act out like a lot of our pain sometimes. Our meanness sometimes.
Yeah.
Because we feel like we're only targeting that shit at like an avatar, like a, you know, you just become something like a profile pic.
Yep. Yep.
And not a real person. But Black radical love means we just got to treat each other better. And I also, like you said something about grace. I always say grace isn't cheap. So I don't like to talk about like grace, like the Hallmarkish American idea of grace. I mean, grace means like you're extending care. And a type of love, or at least a holding space that is enough for people to come to their senses, to make amends. You know, it's not cheap. It don't just mean like people do you wrong, right? And you just like automatically forgive them. It means as part of grace, it means that we're going to change in the process. So I do think you're right that we need to be more graceful. I think that our criticism needs to be more generous. And I think that a big part of our work is also having self-reflection and being self-reflective, like being able, before you call my shit out, I can call it on my own. You know what I'm saying?
Word.
And then doing what we can to make that right.
That's real. So you, on another note, you're a fashionista. Like, Darnell be out here giving looks, okay? First of all, when I got my hair cut, I was like, I need a part. Because Darnell's inspired me to get a part. So now I have, like, my own custom part. Like, how do you use your clothes and your style to tell your story? Like,
oh, my God,
you be
yeah.
out here giving.
Like, I love, and I've always have. And that's the thing, that, you know, because I get tripped on a lot. They be like, you out here always talking about some Black love and social justice, but you up in them, in them Gucci sneakers.
Why we got to pick one? Why we got to pick one?
Listen, I was like, but you know, I've been wearing that since I was in the high school. You know, I was working real hard at 15 and 14, saving my little coins to get my little white kicks and cleaning them things with toothbrushes.
But listen,
I ain't play. I come from a family, though, like, where when I'm talking about style, I mean, even with little, we were able to sort of stylize ourselves. Tutorial, like, and aesthetics was just, like, super important. Like, my mom would not let my sisters walk out the house unless their hair was done type of thing, right? Couldn't even walk to the store unless we had clothes on. You feel me? Like, there was no going to the store in pajamas. You go find you a shirt, you go iron some pants type of thing. I was in leather pants and a ruffle shirt with, a hat on, like, when I was 10, my mom dressed me.
Yes.
So the roots run deep. but I, as a Black person who's perceived as man, cisgender, you know, bearded out, walking through the world, like, I use style, one, as a form of self-representation. It's political for me, too. Like, I just, like, one, I wear what I feel, like, I dress according to how I feel,
mm-hmm.
which is super important. But I also, like, I know, for instance, I had to give a talk. This is a perfect example. At this conference that was about, it brought people from around the country, mayors, their staff, preachers, a whole bunch of people who do work with Black men and boys, right, into conversation. This was a month ago, I think. And I know that most people in that room, when they think about Black boys and men, think that the Black boys and men they ought to be fighting for are mostly straight and cisgender,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the people they imagine in their mind. So you know what I wore to get my closing keynote? A red Calvin Klein suit.
Yes. Yes.
With a gold stripe on the side. And that was a sartorial choice. Like, I made that choice in a room where people I knew would be in suits, mostly in ties or
gray and black,
in a certain type of
way,
right?
Gray and black.
Right. Because it represents, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to wear this red suit. So like that was a move that I did to push against the norms,
mm-hmm.
the rules that tell me as a black man that I am supposed to tighten myself, restrict myself, confine myself, cage myself to some rules. Like I'll wear like a long ass move. Like I'll be, look, and what I love is when I'm walking through the streets of Bed-Stuy or anywhere really, and people just be looking like, yo, he straight up got a beard and like a long shirt on that kind of looked like a dress. Like, what he giving?
He's giving you life. That's what he's giving you is life.
Wait, because then you have little kids, like these little boys that always be running up like, yo, mister, you are so fly. Like, that looks so nice. And that is just like, I want to, you know, give, fashion for me is like freedom. That's it. Yeah, I just come up out the cage. I'm like, I'm wearing whatever I feel. I'm going to get me some. Yeah, I'm short. It's real short. And that's what I felt like. And then next thing you know, I got some other dudes in my neighborhood. They got the same shorts on.
Yeah. Look, style. Okay, style icon. No, I'll be over here like on your Instagram like, yes, Darnell, yes. And anytime he gets a fresh cut, he posted, I'll be like, come on with this lining that is so crisp. Let these people have it. I love it. And I think it's the duality. Like, you don't have to be so... Yes, you should be able to wear Gucci sneakers whenever you want and also then be in a fist-up T-shirt.
I'll wear them together.
Correct. Why not?
Come through. Okay.
Why not? So as you're doing all of this, like, activist, lecturer, teacher, author, host, all of that, how are you taking care of yourself? What is self-care looking like for you?
Oh, my gosh. So this is such an important question. Right now, as I am battling sciatica that just developed last week. And this is, I'm so glad you bring, oh my gosh. So that developed partially, it's sometimes a response to stress, sometimes a response to travel. It's like if you're traveling a lot and you're sitting, it's your sciatic nerve, which is sort of near your buttocks and runs down your leg at the bottom of your spine. I'm on pain meds right now. A few months before that, I ended up in the hospital for 5 days. With a condition called rhabdomyolysis, which is a breakdown of your muscle tissue that flows then into your bloodstream and can damage your kidneys. What happens is, and I'm telling this because this is so important, what happens is you have a protein called creatine kinase. Mm-hmm. You're only supposed to have like 150 to 200 count. My count was 288,000.
What?
And I ended up hospitalized for 5 days. You know how that happened? Because I started working out with a new trainer. And we overdid it. And the next day I got up and I shoveled. And so what's interesting about this is that my body over the last several months, as sort of my travel has kicked up, has been speaking very loudly to me. The rhabdo was like my body saying, you overdid it. You know what I'm saying? I was dehydrated when I was working out. I was, worked out and shoveled the next day, hospitalized for 5 days, missed my very first pre-book launch event. Because I was in the hospital. My body was screaming then. I'm sitting here now, literally sitting here with sciatica. Again, my body is like, you're doing the most. and for particularly for black people, not just black men, but like black folk who are somehow we are, and this is a special issue with black men who will have pains, but we will normalize our pain.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm supposed to feel that way after that workout. This pain in my leg, I'm going to just keep walking, and see you back in the hospital. So I've been much more mindful about listening to my body. I got to travel 6 flights between tomorrow and Sunday.
Oh, my God.
And I'm doing a couple things. Like, y'all, if I'm coming over 4 hours, I don't care what y'all booked. I literally have a condition that requires me not to be sitting too long. You better, you got to get business class or first class.
Yep.
Or I'm not coming.
Yep.
You understand? Because you're not paying my medical bills.
Correct.
Like, these are the types of things I have to do. Or saying, like, you know what? My body right now is screaming, and I can't come.
Yep.
So I'm really, 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 I'm in my 40s early. I'm 42. And black, you know what this get? Like, this is that age where I really have to be thinking about my life, like my well-being. Not just my spirit, but my body too. And in terms of my spirit, I spend lots and lots of time alone and in very small curated communities of friends.
Yeah.
Because I'm in front of a lot of people a lot and a lot of energy. mostly good, but you know, like what people don't see is like they love, you know, some people they like, oh, you live such a great, I'm like, you don't want to switch.
Cause look, you can't even hang.
Listen, like, do you know, like you saw me yesterday on that stage at the Schomburg, but I was on pain meds.
Hmm.
That's the reality. You understand? Like,
yeah.
Or like, you know, I'm out here, I still have a life. I still have, you know, intimate life. When I can have it,
right?
You know, I still got to do things like making sure I have. So, I really try to keep a community of accountability. I have a big brother and a close friend who's a doctor who checks up on me. He's become something like my personal doctor. My landlord and like she's a big sister of mine is also a medical doctor, and my best friend. Like they all like every day they're like, "Where are you? What are you doing? How are you feeling?" And encourage. Two things I just did. I went away to the mountains this past weekend. And did nothing. I like ate at the fire pit and
nice.
Walked by the river. The weekend before that, I went to a beach house and just tried to take time to myself with people that I love, who I trust, who love me back.
Oh, that's so important. That is, I ask every guest this because I need people to understand what it looks like when you are prominent and visible. It might all look nice, but we need to figure out ways to take care of ourselves. So that is clutch. That is so clutch. So I need you to make sure you are taking care of yourself. Say no to a whole bunch of people.
Listen, that no is at the ready, okay?
Because
if this leg, I'm telling you now, if this leg hurting by tonight, I ain't getting on a plane tomorrow. Okay?
Look,
I'm just going to be clear.
People going to have to deal.
They going to have to deal. You better Skype me in.
Y'all better FaceTime him in, Google Hangout him in, something. Take care of yourself. I think it's so important. So I really appreciate that. And you are love in person. Like you are a walking form of love. And I really, really appreciate you for coming on Rants and Randomness and blessing us with these words of wisdom.
I'm honored, actually. I'm honored. Y'all know I love me some lovey. Oh my God.
You are
amazing.
The best. And I want everybody, like if you are listening to this episode and you don't pick up No Ashes in the Fire, me and you going beef. I need y'all to go buy this book. It's everywhere where books are sold. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all that. Independent bookstores. Grab a copy because this book is a gift to the world.
Thank you.
Darnell, I'm going to holler at you. I'm going to text you to see how you're doing.
Appreciate you.
You know, stay up, stay well, stay
Thank
black.
You. You know I'm going to do. That's the one thing I got on lock. I'm going to stay black.
Stay black. All right? We ain't got no other choice but to stay black.
Yeah, and you keep soaring. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Shout out to Darnell Moore for joining me. Y'all see why I love him so dearly? He is a vessel of wisdom and drops gems every time he speaks. Please follow him on social media. He's at More Darnell on Facebook and Instagram and More_Darnell on Twitter. That's MOORE. DARNELL. And please buy his book, No Ashes in the Fire. You can visit his website, darnellmoore.com, for information on his tour, on his book, and all that good stuff. And his book, you can buy anywhere where books are sold. Much love to Chicago Recording Company for partnering with me on this and bringing me the radio voice. Subscribe to Rant and Randomness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get it. Please also rate it. You know what I mean? Review. All that, because if you review it, I might actually shout you out on this show. Follow the podcast on social media. On Twitter, it's at Rants Randomness, no and. And on Instagram, it's at Rants and Randomness. Now, I get a lot of questions in my messages, and I think a lot of them would be good to answer on a bonus episode because they're so universal. If you'd like to send me a question that would possibly be answered on the show, email me at loveyrants@gmail.com. That's loveyrants@gmail.com. And as always, follow me on social media. I'm Lovey everywhere, L-U-V-V-I-E. See you on the next episode.